Charleston, South Carolina has survived countless challenges, from the Revolutionary and Civil War to Mother Nature's wrath of hurricanes and earthquakes. 2 years after the Civil War ended, Dr. William Trott rented the old apothecary shop on Broad Street. His hopes of financial success were dashed when he learned locals were seeking remedies from a root doctor, which led Dr. Trott to offer a show in the apothecary that took a dramatic turn in the summer of 1867. This is the legend of Dr. Trott's apothecary. This is Southern Mysteries.
It's gonna be all right. These ain't dark old troubled times. It's a day like any other day. You got a dark and troubled mind, all right. You hold that baby tight, and I swear if you can hear me, then everything gonna be just fine, all right. All right.
Welcome to Southern Mysteries, exploring historical mysteries and legendary figures of the American South. I'm your host, Shannon Ballard. The Lowcountry is a unique region of the South due to its geography, history, and culture. The exact beginning and end of the Lowcountry is debated as often as the question of the geographical lines of the South. Some will tell you the Lowcountry runs from Jacksonville, North Carolina, south to Jacksonville, Florida. Others maintain the Lowcountry is from Wilmington, North Carolina, on down to Savannah, Georgia. One thing is certain, the area is rich with culture, history, and landscape defined by rivers, waterways, and channel islands winding through the region, making a path to the Atlantic. As Great American Country noted in a piece about the Lowcountry, the region has been shaped by diverse cultures, from native Edesto and Kiowa Indians, planters from Barbados, early French Huguenot settlers, and West African and Caribbean slaves who worked on rice, cotton, and indigo plantations across the Carolinas. In particular, the Gullah Geechees, who arrived in the Lowcountry as slaves from West Africa. Gullah culture influences the Lowcountry with unique language, customs, and traditions. At the heart of Lowcountry is Charleston, South Carolina. Originally named in honor of King Charles II, Charleston was established as the seaport town of Charlestown in 1670. The settlement thrived and would become one of the most profitable centers of trade in the colonies. The success attracted people of means to settle in Charleston, building some of the most stunning architecture of the South, including churches that define the skyline of the city to this day. Those churches have led to Charleston being nicknamed the Holy City. Charleston is a city that has survived countless challenges. It survived the Revolutionary and Civil Wars, and it survived Mother Nature, from an earthquake to hurricanes. The city has faced its fair share of unique challenges, including an 1867 incident involving a mermaid and an apothecary. Long before the big drugstore chains started setting up shops across the country, people relied on apothecaries for their herbal and medicinal remedies. Your local apothecary would sell remedies and, in some cases, offer minor medical procedures. In their early days, apothecaries would offer services such as draining a patient's blood to rid their body of disease. The history of the apothecary in Charleston is rich. At one point, Charleston was known as the home of the oldest drugstore business in the country, a business that began in a clapboard house known as Lining House, a three-story home that still stands in historic Charleston. Named for prominent South Carolina doctor John Lining, the house on the northwest corner of King and Broad Streets was built before 1715. The house was gifted to Lining's wife in 1757, and the family name has been attached ever since, despite no record existing that the family ever lived in the home. By 1780, Lining House would be owned by Dr. Andrew Turnbull, one of the founders of the South Carolina Medical Society, which later became the American Medical Association. In 1781, Dr. Turnbull opened what would be the first of many apothecary shops to operate out of Lining House. Between 1781 to 1960, the apothecary changed ownership a few times. The last pharmacy in the building would be Schwetman's Pharmacy before it closed in 1960. The apothecary in Lining House survived so much. During the Civil War, it was in the bombardment zone from 1863 to 1865, with the front doors being blown out by a shell. The house and the apothecary inside could have been destroyed when that shell hit the building. Miraculously, it didn't explode. It took the owners hundreds of dollars to repair the apothecary and Lining House after the war. And then came riots, Reconstruction-era riots that led to damage across the city. Now, legend says there was another event described by locals as a riot in the summer of 1867. Once again, it threatened Lining House and the apothecary. The legend of this mermaid riot or incident of 1867 is fascinating because it holds a tiny bit of truth wrapped up in exaggeration for dramatic effect, which is the foundation of any good story in the South. 2 years after the Civil War had come to an end, in the spring of 1867, Dr. William Trott rented the old apothecary shop. Trott invested all he had in renting the store and investing money for inventory. He had high hopes that the day he reopened the store, he would find anxious customers willing to spend money for much-needed remedies. His expectations of great success on that first day were crushed. No one came inside, not a single customer. He reminded himself that he had to keep a positive attitude. After all, it was just one bad day. The apothecary had changed hands again, and Trott understood hesitance on the part of people in the neighborhood. Still, he felt confident that customers would come. But after 3 days, he was struggling to maintain that positive attitude. He'd had one customer who had not put his mind at ease. The woman entered the apothecary for headache relief. As Dr. Trott helped her find what she needed, he asked her if she'd heard people around town mention the apothecary or any reason they wouldn't come see him. She reminded Trott that times were hard for a lot of people in the neighborhood. The war had left a lot of people struggling, and many people were still on shaky ground when it came to buying necessities. The apothecary shop and the remedies inside were considered a luxury they couldn't afford. Those who became very ill were seeking help from the local root doctor, not the apothecary. Dr. Trott had never considered his biggest competitor in the world of remedies and care would be a root doctor. He realized he had to do something to bring people into his store and make them see that buying medicine and remedies from him would be money well spent. The root doctor, viewed as Dr. Trott's competition, was a member of the Gullah Geechee Nation. Gullah Geechees were robbed of their freedom, kidnapped from the African nations, and brought to the Lowcountry as slaves from West Africa. The main entry point for the majority of Gullah Geechees was South Carolina's Sullivan Island, not far from Charleston. They had no way to communicate because they were all from different West African nations. They created a language of their own, which afforded them communication and a connection. The people, their language, is known as Gullah Geechee. Following the Civil War and the Emancipation Proclamation, which freed slaves, the Gullah Geechee remained on the Sea Islands along the Lowcountry. They preserved the part of their ancestors that could never be enslaved, their beliefs and cultural history. This included the Gullah Geechee tradition of hoodoo and root work. When you hear the word hoodoo, it's often misunderstood. Many assume hoodoo and voodoo are one in the same, but they are very different. Sin Elias is the owner of New Orleans Crescent City Conjure. He works to clarify the difference between hoodoo and voodoo. St. Elias explains that voodoo is a religion that practices veneration in honor of the Lwa, spiritual beings believed to have the power to influence human destiny. Serving the Lwa is central to the religion of voodoo. Human beings honor them to avoid punishment and misfortune. Hoodoo is all about ancestors. It is an ancestor-based folk magic, African-American folk magic, that was a direct result of the African-American slave trade. Hoodoo remembers and honors the blood, sweat, and tears of ancestors who enabled the practitioners to exist. The relationship is sacred and has come from a culture of survival. Gullah Geechee Hoodoo practitioners use spells and charms, sacred rituals and roots, to call on the spirit of healing for any desired result. They recite biblical texts during these rituals, most often reciting psalms. Gullah Geechees believe that anything that ails you, any sickness or injury, is rooted in spiritual evil. Medicine isn't the cure for those who are ill, struggling, or finding themselves facing hard times. The Gullahs had to find the answers, these cures, on their own, because they were slaves who would not receive medical care. They had to look to nature, to herbs and plants, any home remedy they could find to treat illness and injury. A practice that continued after emancipation and their continued isolation on the Sea Islands off the Georgia and South Carolina coast. Here in the Lowcountry, folks still call hoodoo Lowcountry voodoo. Terrence Zepke has researched root doctors and hoodoo rituals for her book, Lowcountry Voodoo, sharing examples of treatments root doctors have used for generations. One is a treatment for colds and flu, called Life Everlasting. The treatment is a chest rub made from whiskey, lemon, and turpentine. Zepke notes that this and many other root doctor products like it were actually sold in Charleston shops well into the mid-1900s, but they were not offered in Dr. Trott's apothecary in the 1860s. If you wanted that kind of cure, you went to the root doctor. Dr. Trott was reminded of these affordable healthcare options when that customer seeking headache relief came into his store and shared about people finding comfort and care that cost little to nothing when they sought help from the root doctor. Some swore by these remedies, but Dr. Trott was a man who considered root doctors to be charlatans, a joke, until more and more people turned to the root doctor and passed by his apothecary. Trott knew he had to figure out a way to change minds and improve his financial situation. He needed something to attract people to his store. He felt if he could just convince people to enter the door of the apothecary, he could sell them on his medicines and remedies. He brainstormed ideas, ways to make this happen. And then he remembered the Fiji mermaid. Dr. Trott, who was originally from New York, recalled showman P.T. Barnum's infamous hoax in New York and Boston in the 1840s. In 1842, Barnum contacted newspapers to inform them that a Dr. Griffin of the London Lyceum of Natural History was coming to America. Barnum informed the press that the good doctor was bringing with him a mermaid he had captured off the Fiji Islands. Barnum wrote that he hoped the doctor would find interest in displaying the mermaid to the public. It seems there was so much excitement over the idea of a mermaid being displayed in America that the press neglected some fact-checking. If they had asked more questions, they would have learned that neither Dr. Griffin nor the London Lyceum of Natural History existed, and the mermaid they wanted to display had been displayed in London and didn't quite live up to ticket holders' expectations. When a Dr. Griffin checked into a New York hotel, it was actually Barnum's friend Levi Lyman playing the role of a lifetime. The press heard Griffin was in town and begged him to display the mermaid for the public. Let the people see this creature. Dr. Griffin and P.T. Barnum put on a show for the press, making it look as though they were feuding over the right place to display the mermaid. finally, they reached a public compromise. Dr. Griffin displayed the mermaid for a week at the New York Concert Hall and then agreed to allow Barnum to display it at his American Museum. This allowed them both to benefit from the buzz and the ticket sales. The mermaid people were anxious to see. Well, it was nothing like the beautiful sea creatures we usually picture in our mind or have seen portrayed in Disney movies. It was a shriveled mermaid or being that people paid to see that was really part fish and part monkey that had been sewn together for display. Barnum would later share in his autobiography that the creature looked hideous, describing it as an ugly, dried-up specimen about 3 feet long. Its mouth was open, its tail turned over, and its arms thrown up, giving it the appearance of having died in agony. If you find this description off-putting, imagine paying money to see a mermaid, and that's the creature you see. Ticket holders were angry, threatened to attack the display. Barnum, always the showman, waited out the controversy and eventually sent the mermaid on a tour of other cities and states in America. Now, by 1867, for most people, it was a distant and bad memory. But for Dr. Trott, it was inspiration and his hope for a new life at the apothecary. Dr. Trott covered the windows of the apothecary and displayed a sign outside reading, "Free magic show in 4 days." He used all the money he had to his name to purchase supplies that he needed to pull off his magic show. And day after day, he would change the sign out front, causing some buzz to begin to spread around the neighborhood. "Free magic show in 3 days. Free magic show in 2 days." And it had the desired effect. People started talking, spreading the word, asking if anyone knew about this show at the apothecary. Trott even had curious customers stopping by to ask if they could come inside to buy something. But Trott knew letting anyone inside would diminish the excitement, ruin the surprise. The shop remained closed, and once the sign changed to "Free Magic Show Tomorrow," you could feel the anticipation around Charleston. Dr. Trott could feel it, and he was fueling it by passing out flyers, promoting the magic show at the apothecary. When he arrived to unlock the shop doors on the day of the show, Dr. Trott had to maneuver through a sea of curious locals who had come to see the magic. He told the crowd that they would have to enter in groups because space was limited. The first group entered the shop, and Trott instructed them to look around for any remedies they might need. He went upstairs to open the show for the anxious crowd. Soon after, he returned and invited his guests to join him. As the group climbed the stairs, they entered a dimly lit room, and much to their delight, they gazed upon a room full of ocean and river exhibits. Now, aquariums weren't a common part of American life at this time. For a port city like Charleston, fish were for eating, not something that you put on display, which is why people were kind of in awe. Dr. Trott had spent all he had on glass tanks and lights to highlight the beauty of the fish, reptiles, frogs, seahorses, and turtles that he had on display. People moved cautiously about the room to look at each tank and see what was inside. And Dr. Trott was pretty pleased with himself. He had spent days catching the sea life and the river creatures in those tanks. But the show wasn't over. Trott instructed the crowd to follow him to the back of the room where they could see the star of the show. In a dramatic move, Trott proclaimed that those gathered in this room were about to gaze upon what few men ever see in a lifetime, a real live mermaid. At that moment, Trott pulled back a sheet that had been covering the largest glass tank in the room. Inside were plants and shells and large fish. The water was a little murky, which led people to lean forward to try to see what else was inside. Moments later, someone noticed what looked like a large tail, something swimming behind a plant in the tank, and a man was heard calling out, "I see her. I see the mermaid. She's a beauty." That moment was all Dr. Trot could have hoped for. One after one, people in the room began to scream that they had seen her too. And that's when Trot knew he had to leave these people wanting more. He threw the sheet back over the tank and told the crowd that more groups were waiting and it was time to go back downstairs and give them the chance to experience this too. As group after group entered the store that day, they went upstairs to see the magic show and the mermaid, and then descended the stairs and spent money in Dr. Trot's apothecary. By the end of the day, Dr. Trot found his financial situation was improving. But not everyone in town found this magic show to be a gift. As people were in line to get into the apothecary, a root doctor stood on the street, heard people talking. She heard what this magic show was all about and felt ill at ease. She knew that doctor was up to something that could lead to pain for the people of Charleston. Inside the apothecary, Dr. Trot was wondering how long he could keep this up. Maybe he could keep the show running for weeks or months, but his hopes and his plans were ruined by Mother Nature. A few days after the magic show opened at the apothecary, a hurricane hit Charleston. National Weather Service records show that the storm, later classified as a Category 1, made landfall near Charleston in late June of 1867. The storm lingered, causing widespread rain and flooding. The Charleston News would describe this storm, noting, "Day after day, night after night, have the floods descended until patience has been exhausted and forbearance has ceased to be a virtue. The oldest inhabitant does not remember a more continued spell of wet weather." Residents lost homes, business owners lost their shops and restaurants. The apothecary roof was damaged, which led to leaks inside. The owner of the building told Dr. Trot repairs would be made just as soon as the rain stopped. It felt as though that day would never come. The root doctor felt she knew why. She approached Dr. Trot in the apothecary and told him the storm and all the damage it had caused and continued to cause was his fault. She explained that the mermaid he was holding in captivity had brought about this pain and suffering. She believed the mermaid had a baby that remained at sea. The sea would continue to churn and rain would continue to fall until the creature was set free, allowed to reunite with her child. The root doctor's message was clear. Free the mermaid, return her to the sea, and the rain would end. As the rain continued to fall, tension was rising. More and more residents in Charleston were inclined to believe the root doctor. Maybe this was about the mermaid and the show at the apothecary. Many who trusted the root doctor, not just for remedies, but for spiritual guidance, were concerned about what was happening, what would continue to happen. The final straw came when a little boy died, drowned as he tried to save his beloved dog from floodwaters. And those who believed the root doctor's warning that Dr. Trot's refusal to free the mermaid would lead to pain and suffering, they descended on Dr. Trot's apothecary, banging on the windows, yelling for Trot to free the mermaid he was holding inside. The Daily News reported over 500 people were present as they rallied outside of the apothecary. Minutes later, they stormed the shop and demanded Dr. Trot hand over the mermaid, release her back to the sea. They were ready for this curse on Charleston to end. Trot tried to protect his own interest. He said the root doctor viewed him as competition, was lying, trying to run him out of town. But as the mob grew, so did Trot's fear for his own life. Finally, he told the mob that the curse couldn't be true because there was no mermaid to set free. There had never been a mermaid. It was all magic, an illusion, a lie. Trat's confession was meant to calm the angry mob, but it did not work. Most of the people in that crowd thought his confession was a lie. Trat insisted the crowd follow him, come inside the store, come with him, see that that mermaid was not in the tank upstairs. So the crowd rushed in. As they made their way upstairs, some of them were hoping to free the mermaid. Others were curious to see if Trat was telling the truth. The moment the crowd started rushing up the stairs, the roof, which had already sustained significant damage during the hurricane, was heard making cracking sounds. Seconds later, the crowd below felt debris landing on them as the roof collapsed, felt the sting of rain falling on them. Those glass tanks shattered, and with the broken glass, fish, turtles, reptiles, and shells that had been inside spilled out into the house as rain continued to fall into and flood the apothecary. The crowd was shaken, some of them in shock, as they carefully tried to stand up and move as the creatures that had been in the glass case were seen floating by them. They would later say they saw fins and tails. One man swore he saw that mermaid swim away from the apothecary, that she was finally free. They couldn't help but wonder if it was true, because within minutes, the rain that had plagued the area for days stopped. The sun returned, and in the days that followed, the waters receded. Locals focused on rebuilding and restoring homes and businesses around Charleston. Somehow, as it always had, the Lining House survived what became known as the Mermaid Riots of 1867. The house was repaired, and Dr. Trat continued to offer up remedies for the locals, as did the root doctor, who found more and more people coming to her for help after the mermaid incident. Now, the story of the mermaid riot has passed from generation to generation. Some folks empathize with Dr. Trot's desperation to make his business work, even if they disagree with his method. For the Gullah root doctor and her ancestors, who had been freed from enslavement just 2 years before the mermaid riot, you can appreciate their discomfort with Trot's magic show and the idea of a mermaid being kidnapped and displayed in that glass case. What they knew, understood more than anyone else, was that any being, human or otherwise, captured and taken from all they love, brought pain and fear to the surface again. You can understand why the root doctor and the crowd who gathered at the apothecary were so determined to free that mermaid. Whether she existed or not, the mermaid was a symbol of what so many had lost and vowed to never lose again. Freedom. Southern Mysteries is hosted and produced by me, Shannon Ballard. The old apothecary shop, made famous by the mermaid incident tale, passed on to many owners before it moved from Lining House to a new location on Lower King Street in the early 20th century. The store remained open until the final owners, the Tellis family, closed their doors in 2012. Lining House still stands strong, serving as the home of a legal firm on the corner of King and Broad in Charleston's business district. You can see photos of Lining House and the old apothecary in the show notes for this episode at southernmysteries.com. There you can also learn more about the Gullah Geechee Cultural Heritage Corridor, a 12,000-square-mile federal national heritage area that includes places of historical and cultural significance to the Gullah Geechee people. October marks the second anniversary of Southern Mysteries. Whether you've listened since the first episode or you're new to the show and catching up, you're the reason I keep researching and writing and producing Southern Mysteries. I hope you continue to listen and enjoy the show. If you want to support all the hard work that goes into making Southern Mysteries, you can do that by tapping on the support tab on the website and by buying a t-shirt or a mug in the shop that you'll find there. You can find links to support and to shop at southernmysteries.com. Thanks for listening.